Welcome to Belt to Loaded, the officially unofficial podcast for The Expanse on Amazon Prime Streaming. I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 7, titled Oh Yeah Dang. Every once in a while I get to A, learn what a new Belter word means, and B, try and pronounce it right at the beginning of the podcast, and this is no exception. Aaron, you looked up Oh Yeah Dang, didn't you? What does it mean?
So, Oh Yeah Dang is a Belter farewell. It's like essentially saying goodbye, so long. Oh Yeah is hello. Oh Yeah Dang is goodbye. So, I think by the time you hit the credit sequence of this week's episode, the meaning of this will become clear. There's a lot of open-ended questions about the goodbye, and like, it's a weird, like, non-cliffhanger because I think you're supposed to understand that Naomi survives her farewell, but to what end? Because, you know, she's got a hunk of junk kind of space freighter against one of the most sophisticated, well-armed ships in the solar system. So I'm very curious to see what kind of die-hard plan she comes up with to get away from Philip and try not to get the Rossi killed. Yeah, that's what it means.
What did you think of the episode?
It's good. I tell you what, the scene between Sin and Naomi is one of the most emotionally effective scenes that's been in this entire series. Like, I really like Sin. I think the guy's just got a likable face, and he's got that kind of like big burly personality, and like the kind of instant like father-daughter relationship that they efficiently forged with their characters is surprisingly effective. Because like I said, I found myself getting caught up in the acting between the two. I felt genuine betrayal and love and a lot of complicated stuff. Really impressed with the character, the actor that's portraying Philip. I think he's doing a great job of this kid that's being pulled between these two gravitational forces of his parents. I also really like the stuff between Bull and Holden. Like, they're doing a lot of stuff to really flesh out some of these new characters and have them impact the story. And to get all that goodness, we had to sacrifice Amos entirely. But, you know, he's had some pretty good showcase episodes, so I wasn't mad about that. And we got some pretty quality space battle porn in this episode, which I always like. So
anytime the PDCs come on, anytime the PDCs happen, I am happy.
Yeah, something about all that tracer fire spiraling. It's beautiful. It's geometric. It's exciting. I do love like the signature of one of the signatures of the show is the space combat and kind of the realistic techno nature of it. So I thought it's cool. What did you think of the episode?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I was impressed by the same scenes you're talking about. I'm freshly impressed by Dominic Tipper in this episode. Like, that scene she has with Philip is so complex emotionally, and it never strikes a false note, you know, and he's doing great work here too. It's both of them together, but I feel like it's noteworthy to point out when an actor who's been doing good work all along kind of steps into another gear. And this scene for me was that. For her, but there's a lot of that, right? That scene with Sin is another standout, like you said. There's just so much like familial and platonic strife here in this episode. That's, you know, I don't know. I think the people who are watching The Expanse are in it for things like that too, right? It's not just every time the Rossi gun ports open up and the PDCs pop out. It's that's really cool too, and we love that. But yeah, these characters, the way, yeah, you talked about Sin, who you really like. It's amazing to think that six episodes ago we didn't know who Sin was. We had never heard of the guy, and now we're having deeply emotional scenes with rich backstory between the two characters, and it's all working extremely well, in my opinion.
Especially since some of this stuff interlocks, like the seeing Drummer and her crew, which is a very young, new kind of unit. Like, and like, this is a fairly freshly forged family, and how tightly knit they are. Seeing Sin and Naomi is just essentially like what if we stayed with this crew for several years and we saw them actually form family relationships, and you had like father, grandfather, son, daughter type relationships form, and how much more close-knit it would be. So and I think the show intentionally does this stuff by showing all this stuff, how unusually close-knit like Tremors group is compared to like the 21st century kind of faction making, you know. Like it's not just like a military unit. It's not just a family unit. It's like, it's not just like your coworkers. It's like all that stuff, all those bonds fused into one. It really helps us. It really helps it land. You know, they're allowed to get away with like Sin having maybe 15 minutes of screen time in the 7 hours that we've seen before. And instantly, you know, we identify him as the Papa Bear being kind of torn apart. Like, hidden thing is like, you know, we were a family. I loved all of us. I didn't want any of us to leave. I was doing what I thought would keep us all together. Like, who can't identify with a person wanting to keep their family together in trying times? And there's always trying times when you're a belter, you know?
Yeah.
It's great. It's great. And yeah, like you said, if we can get an episode, it's got packed with action and packed with that character development, that's peak expanse for me.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Shall we get into the episode proper?
Yeah, let's do it.
So we open up with some nostalgic scenes of a much younger Marco and Naomi cuddling with their infant scene Philip, intercut with present Naomi kind of looking pensive and drained, and Philip reading up on his mother's exploits in Ringgate. His father interrupts Philip's reading and requests to use his ship to Chainsmoker before taking some time to taunt Naomi with old memories and freedom to roam about the ship.
I'm not buying it, Philip. I'm not buying it. You say the ship means nothing to you. If it doesn't mean something to you in the moment, it's going to mean something to you later. And this stuff that Naomi's saying about the price that he's going to pay for the things he's doing now, it couldn't be more evident. Like, giving away this ship that his mother gave him, especially with the way things go down in this episode, boy, that's got to weigh on you.
Yeah. And it's really telling that Philip doesn't feel comfortable telling his father the truth about what he's reading up on.
Yeah.
Like, most natural thing in the world, a young boy meeting his mother for the first time, finding out about her, you know, he's already got an impressive father. It probably flatters his own flatter his own self-image to think his mother is just as badass in perhaps different ways, and trying to find out, you know, he knows nothing about her, trying to know everything about it. But he doesn't feel comfortable letting his father know that. Like, the way he plays that is like a kid, his parent walks in on him jerking off or something. Which, by the way, Philip, shut your door, maybe turn it to where you're come on, this is teenager 101. Don't have your view screen angled towards the door where people can just barge in on you. Come on. And also, Marco, what are you doing? You're gonna walk on this kid doing something that you don't want to see. If not today,
hey, man,
then someday.
The Belter families are different. They're close.
That's
you
true.
Know, they're real close.
The dads walk in, are you jerking it, son?
Make sure you turn on the suction devices. We turn on the ceiling vents because we don't want that stuff floating down the halls.
Yeah, don't want the cycler shorted out by jizz again. You know, that's a lot of downtime.
Getting the air recyclers, we're all going to be smelling it for weeks. Yeah, so I agree. Like, you can imagine how much poisoning Marco's done, because they haven't really they haven't really shown a lot of that. Like, it's brought up sort of in passing every time, right? That, like, oh, Naomi says, oh, he's probably poisoned you against me, and how Sin helped and all that stuff. But, like, it's sort of there in the background. And this, things like this sort of help to reinforce the idea that Marco has been talking in Philip's ear about his mother for 17 years or however long he's been alive. And so you can see, like, even if it is a natural thing to be curious about your mother, this particular mom might not be something that he wants Marco to know he's researching.
Yeah, he knows instinctively that this is kind of forbidden knowledge. I looked into some world building. They talk about Pallas and how that was the site of their first victory. That's where they blew up the Sodom and Gomorrah, or whatever. Augustine, yeah. It's the third largest asteroid in the system by size and mass, by volume and mass, right behind Ceres and Vesta. It's 500 kilometers in diameter. This is a big rock, a really large rock. But it has a highly eccentric and elliptical orbit. So if you don't know what that means, most planetoids in the solar system all orbit the same direction, kind of roughly in the same plane. And they kind of have usually, you know, they're all kind of elliptical, but they have mostly circular orbits. Elliptical means it's very oval-shaped orbit, and eccentric means it's tilted almost 45 degrees from the plane of the solar system.
Wow.
And I was wondering, like, I instantly started wondering, like, man, is that seems like it would isolate the asteroid for a lot, because it required an enormous amount of delta V to, like, get out of the plane of the solar system and then go visit this lonely rock. So, like, through most of its orbit, do they like kind of resupply and build up on it when it's close to the plane, and then as it gets out, it's kind of like being on a deep haul, almost extra galactic cruiser? Or I wonder if Dan and Ty even think about that stuff when they're writing it. But it seems like it's the perfect type of place that would maybe brew a particular type of isolationist kind of, you know, militant do it for yourself type of belter.
Oh yeah. I'm sure they have thought of that. I don't think they pick these places without thinking about why they're picking them. I didn't know that. That's interesting information. I could totally see that factoring in.
Yeah. I don't know what they do, because I know, like, the asteroids they picked for this earlier in the season as a meeting place had the high albedo ratings. They're, like, super bright mm-hmm. and shiny, so you couldn't see, like, ships orbiting around them. Like, that seems like they did handpick the location, but... Mm-hmm. You know, it's a big rock. The other thing I thought was really cool is finding out more about Naomi's motivations for leaving. Like, it's always kind of been nebulous. These are always, like, things in her backstory that we kind of knew the rough details of, but, like, she's never come out and talked about, like, why did she leave? Why did she feel compelled? And, like, Marco tries to make her feel guilty about this stuff, but she's able to effectively punch back with, you know, the pain of losing Philip wasn't as bad as the relief of leaving you and knowing that I wouldn't have to be under your thrall anymore. And the one that particularly stung him is Holden being all the things that you pretend to be. Because I do think there's still some jealousy here. Like, I do think Marco really still is carrying a torch for Naomi. He even says as much, like, nothing ever hurt me as much as losing you. All these, I think, are a really toxic brew that ends up culminating in what we end the episode with, his kind of rather, you know, insane plot to turn his son against his mother and destroy Holden in front of her before spacing her.
Oh, yeah. No, he's a remarkably insecure man when it comes to his ego, his reputation, the perception that people have of him, that's very fragile. And it feels like his hold on people is very fragile as well. You know, he is a great manipulator, and he's able to trap people in his web with that skill. But I feel like at any moment that whole thing could just come tumbling down, and then he would be turned on. Like Sin is an example of someone who is right on the ragged edge here. There is an alternate version of this episode, I think, where when Naomi looks over at Sin, instead of turning his back on her, which is extremely powerful and upsetting, he stands up and he takes Margo's head off. Like, I honestly believe that he is torn, and there have to be people around Marco, a ton of them around Marco that are just like him. People who are just barely hanging on to what he's saying here. And Naomi points out all the things that make him that way, right? Like this idea that he wouldn't have done the Augustine Gamora stuff if he knew that, you know, it would drive Naomi away is complete bullshit. Complete bullshit. Yeah. I don't believe it for a second, but it's something he's just saying to get into her head. And I think Naomi, like, he tries to leave her with this thing of like, oh, if you try to do anything else, Philip will know exactly who you are. I think Naomi wants that. That is exactly what Naomi wants, for Philip to actually understand who his parents are and see the truth here.
Yeah, I think it is a huge mistake for him to allow her essentially free run of the ship, because she's going to use it to exploit all of his weaknesses. I kept on thinking about, because, you know, a lot of people have been name checking George Orwell this week. Can't imagine why. And, you know, a lot of people throwing around 1984, but Animal Farm, I was thinking about while I was watching this episode, because it does feel like I started classifying people like Sin, major, you know, he's a boxer, the strong, stalwart type, just wants people to get along, wants to move in to succeed. Naomi is Snowball and Marco is Napoleon, which is the good and bad pigs, respectively, the Animal Farm movement. And I just think it was interesting to kind of like sort those, because like as I started doing that, it's like these dynamics started to make sense, you know.
Yeah.
And like how Marco has the hold on these people.
It's really not hard to see people for what they are if you just take an honest look at them, right? Like we all intuitively understand that stuff, and they're doing a great job on the show of showing that.
Yeah, showing how our biases and our emotions and our attachments can like override, like you said, that easy snap judgment of like what feels good to your gut, what looks good, what passes the smell test.
Yeah.
So DeRossi is still on the hunt for the Zemea, which is fleeing Tycho Station with their boosted sample of the protomolecule that they stole from Fred. And Bull and Holden get to talk one-on-one about their troubled relationship with Fred Johnson, which I found fascinating.
You know, I find fascinating. It'll be interesting to see where exactly Holden is keeping his bat cave on the Rocinante, because his armor, I mean, he looks just like the Dark Knight, right? Did you see him in this battle armor?
He's kind of the only one wearing it, too, right?
He really is.
He's got the full on Dark Knight to go. And I guess it's like if you're in like a combat situation, you should always be wearing. But like. Yeah, I don't know, because like if he's wearing his helmet, like if everyone was essentially suited up, ready for hard vacuum at all times, as if they're ready for combat. But I don't know, maybe he's just that's his spacesuit.
I mean,
you know,
his pilot, arguably the most important person if you get into a firefight, is just wearing a jumpsuit. Like he could be on an ice hauler in the middle of nowhere.
I think you're supposed to understand those things with the strappy straps are actually full on hard vac spacesuits.
Okay. So at least
like
if
Monica is the only one wearing an actual jumpsuit, I think. But like, yeah, everyone's essentially a helmet away from being insulated against vacuum. But no, it is funny. Him and his it looks like someone killed his mom and dad in Crime Alley.
Yep.
And he's looking for payback for sure.
And I don't know if this is supposed to be funny, but there's this moment where they ask like, okay, if we get the protomolecule, what are we going to do with it, guys? And they go around the room and everybody says, destroy it. And they're all just kind of like, I feel like, I don't know. It was just really funny to me, this look they're giving each other. And
especially when Holden says, like, destroy it, obviously. And I think they're setting up some tension, because I don't know that we knew what Bull thought about it. You know, is he going to be kind of like, you know, taking a Fred Johnson? I think we kind of, why would he ever take like a Belter first approach? Mm-hmm. Or even Belter equal approach. But I think there's supposed to be some like tension about like who would say what, and also setting up Holden for some possible hypocrisy that he might be putting Naomi before the protomolecule. But I don't know, like maybe we can discuss it as the episode wears on, but I never even thought they really came close to making that a genuine thing. where it's like, you know, he was taking chances with getting a Protomolecule out versus rescuing Naomi.
I just want a scene every single episode, maybe two every episode, where they check in. We're still on the same page, right, guys, about this Protomolecule. We get it. We destroy it. Okay.
Yeah, we're going to destroy it, obviously. I really like Bull's statement about if you spend a time with people, you get to learn how full of shit they are. I spent a half a lifetime with Fred and I still don't know. And he's like, that's a rare kind of breed. And I was like, I think that's interesting where you meet a person who's like, you know, they're saying stuff that's like so high minded and idealistic and whatnot that it seems like they have to be full of shit. But like you sit and watch and like, OK, where's the hypocrisy going to be? Where's the hypocrisy going to be? And it's like, and it's not that like I thought it also that like Holden says that Fred never lied to him. Is that literally true? Because I feel like that Fred, I don't know, at least withheld the truth on multiple occasions. You know, the whole existence of the Protomolecule, where it's at, what he's doing with it, all that kind of stuff. Like, I wonder if this is more of like not wanting to speak ill of the dead, or maybe, you know, Fred Johnson in death is starting to look like, you know, now that Marco is like taking over the Belter, like, hey, you know, Dawes and Johnson, maybe not so bad. Maybe guys I could have in retrospective worked with a little bit more. But it's a great line.
It is, yeah. And then the fact that he is sort of assessing Holden as the same kind of guy, right? And maybe that's why they, despite not getting along, maybe that's, you know, why they can work together. It's good. I think all those characters, we've got so much history with Fred and Holden that we understand intuitively what Bull is saying here and the relationship that they must have had too.
Yeah, and if you're keeping score at home and looking to see where the chips are falling as far as like Bull perhaps taking over piloting duty, these character moments are going to be vital to like him being part of the crew, because this is not quashing the beef with him and Holden, but like properly framing it. And I, for one, actually think it would be cool if there is one crewman that kind of thinks Holden's full of shit. Because everybody else just thinks Holden, you know, Naomi, Alex, Amos think that he fucking hung the moon and invented morality and philosophy. And Bull's like, yeah, whatever, pretty boy, to talk with the big fucking mouth. I kind of like that dynamic. A little bit of McCoy, you know, like in the original Star Trek, like he's the kind of cranky one that's going to call bullshit on these on the Vulcan and the, you know, the space jock every once in a while. I think they could use that. What do you make of the fact that Bull's like, fuck Fred Johnson's last wishes, I ain't gonna feed him the mushrooms? I thought I was trying to say, what does that tell us about his character?
I don't know, because Fred's dead, baby, you know. it doesn't matter what he wants anymore when he's dead. Like he'll never know. We want to honor him because we're living and we need it. I could see all of that stuff making a certain amount of sense.
I also wonder if, because like, you know, not for nothing, the Rocinante is being crewed by Belters of questionable loyalty. I do wonder if like this is like a little one of those things in retrospect that might bite you know, him flippant attitude towards respect for Belter custom. Something that Fred Johnson, very smart man, very politically minded, you know, like that, this is a thing where it's like you lay him to rest in a recycling station means a hell of a lot more to Belters, who might be influenced about like, you know what, Fred was butcher of Anderson Station, say what you will, you know, my baby's eating him in my baby formula, he's a real Belter going out like that way, versus like, ah, the fucker, I knew it, he's selfishly keeping his atoms to himself. Like, it's something, and I wonder if he might regret that kind of flippant attitude later.
Could be.
They also discover at the very end of the scene, they get a transmission from Alex, and they're all shocked to realize that Alex is far from Mars and he's out in the space. And there's a very I like the realism of them realizing this just from the communication delay. Like, what the fuck? And it's kind of like a fun mutual realization as the episode goes on. Moving on, Naomi uses her newfound freedom to move about the cabin to visit Philip in his quarters, and she levels with him about why she left their family and her father and how she feels about Marco.
And I I couldn't help but notice at the beginning, you know, I talked about how Naomi's words are sort of landing with Marco, but equally, I think Marco's words are landing with Naomi, right? The idea that she doesn't know who her son is, and that, yeah, she was there when he was a baby, but Marco has been there for the last X amount of years. It's evident here when she's snooping around Philip's cabin that what she's trying to do is get an assessment of who this guy is, who her son is, right? But picking up that razor, she's looking at all the projects he's got going, right? The things he's doing, trying desperately to understand him. And it doesn't feel like she's trying to understand him so that she can manipulate him like Marco would, but so she can simply know who her son is. I thought that was a nice moment.
It's so powerful in nonverbal way to, like, you know, in the beginning of the episode when it shows Naomi thinking about her son, it's in terms of him being this baby. And now she's physically coming to grips with the fact that biologically, at least, he's a man. He's shaving, you know, that's kind of the quintessential rite of passage for masculine types, is like, oh, God, this shit's coming out of my face. I better start scraping it off. I thought it was really, really great. And I thought, again, just like we're going to appreciate with Sin later, I think Dominic Tripper is the thing that makes all this stuff work. Like, you know, she's a very good dance partner in these types of scenes. But this Philip kid is holding his own. Like, I really, really felt it, like, when they're leveling and he kind of, like, reverts kind of to that boy, like curls up in her arms to be comforted by his mother in a way that he's never gotten from his father. You just know, want to curl up in his father's lap and just cry for a minute. That's not fucking happening.
He's got to be strong. He's got to be a strong belter. And that is a huge moment for Naomi too, right? There's this complicated stew of, like, this is what she wants, and also this is not the circumstance under which she wanted it. And she now has this job of trying to convince this kid that what he's doing is monstrous, but not doing it in a way that's going to completely destroy him, like doing it in a way that means he can come back from this. Yeah. It's complicated. And I think Dominic just nails it.
I thought this was great because shame, like guilt is a neutral thing. Guilt is an acknowledgement of something that you've done, and you're taking responsibility for it. But shame is almost always just a toxic emotion. And I thought it was interesting how they compare and contrast Marco, who's quick to, like, you know, say, assign, you know, well, you should be ashamed for what you're doing. And you can see how he plays on this with Naomi. Also, I thought it was really great to see, like, that's one of the hardest things to deal with as a parent, to realize that, like, your child is going to be so much like you. And for that reason, probably deal with a lot of same things that you did, but they're also completely their own person. So while you can give them advice and you can kind of draw parallels, at the end of the day, when they say, like, yeah, well, fine, but that's not me, and that's not you have to kind of take them seriously. And it's really a high stakes game for Naomi. I mean, he's not talking about borrowing the car to go for prom or, you know, going to a party where there might be drinking. We're talking about, you know, killing hundreds of millions of people here. But it still resonates, or at least it did with me. And the idea of she thought her choice was killing herself because she couldn't live with it. She realized that was not a choice. That's still like giving herself to, like, playing Marco's game. The only choice anyone can ever make is to walk away from the situation, because then there's always hope for the future. You might be able to affect positive change. Yeah. You know, if Naomi blew herself out an airlock 16 years ago, none of this would ever happen. And the you know, who knows what would happen with this? Hell, I don't know what the solar system is going to look like at the end of the season. But that one person's change is going to have a profound effect, which I think is a great message for people, you know? Mm-hmm. I imagine a lot of people could see themselves in Naomi's position in the airlock. But her having the strength to keep going on, even though so much is stacked against her, is pretty inspiring.
And the fact that she couldn't have known it when she made that choice, right? That's the thing that's so powerful, is, like, you can look at, you know, your actions and say, well, they don't mean anything. And they may not mean anything in the context of the moment, but they could certainly mean something in the context of the future. And that is the big game changer. That's the thing where you can really affect change, make an impact with a single action, with a single choice.
Yeah. It's an act of faith, not a faith in God or some spirituality or religion, but an act of faith in yourself that you can make things better. Faith in others, that like the world's not always going to be this dark, depressing place, and that everyone is going to be looking to take advantage and manipulate people. And, you know, look at what she's been able to do since.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Bobby and Alex aboard the Screaming Firehawk receive some intel and attaboys from Avasarala before going on to pass Marco's ship profiles on to Holden and the crew of the Rocinante.
Yeah, I think it's also important to know that they passed them on to Earth, to Avasarala, who has had Jupiter and Saturn fleets sort of leave task forces throughout their path home, so that, you know, if Marco ships are out there, they will probably find them. So Earth is like mounting a defense here, right? It's not just that the Belters are, you know, like, Earth is in chaos, hair on fire, ass catching, and
right,
and they have no idea what to do, and Marco's running roughshod over the system.
Yeah, it feels very much like Avasarala is in more control than I was suspected. Like, I think this transportation secretary is essentially just like, whatever you say, madam. Whatever, it's, that sounds good. That sounds strong. That sounds like it's going to keep us safe. Like, it seems like there's a lot of, I wonder if they'll ever push back on that, or maybe if she's just keeping a deaf hand, or maybe I'm just thinking that because she's running the Bobby operation. But it does feel like, she has really ensconced herself, and she's pulling the power as a lever, because this is total Avasarala. Like, pull back, Earth first, almost protect the inner planets, which I think is interesting because Mars is included in that.
Yeah,
like, this does feel very kind of tribal, that like, okay, the well wallas are going to going to band together against those goddamn belters.
Right? It's playing into the hands of Marco also. It's like, it if does. You need a thing to point to say, see, it's us against them. Well, here you go.
Yeah. And I wonder if she's smart enough to see that. Like, I would like to see another scene of like her and that the other admiral, Delgado, I think is his name. Like, maybe because she's always talking like, think like the enemy. You know, don't just do the things that Marco wants you to do. If you abandon the outer planets to him, then, well, you're abandoning the outer planets to him. And that means any belters who might be sympathetic to you, who might want to resist, are going to get snapped up or executed. Seems like something that feels smart, but is long-term foolish. But we'll see. I really like the back and forth between Bobby and Alex, because Alex kind of like, hey, I know she didn't mention that ship we blew up, and Bobby's like, "Yeah, well, if you want one of my Martian medals," and because that's what, you know, Alex is a little bit of a glory hound, and I like her busting his nuts.
Yeah, and also Holden stuff over there. I really like it because you expect Holden. Like, there's this moment where he finds out that Naomi's ship is among the group of ships that Alex sends over. And there's this moment where Monica and Bull are like, uh-oh, Holden. He's going to be just this untamable beast that goes after her full throttle. He cuts off the other mission, and they all look to him and like, we're still on track here, right? He says, of course.
Checking in again. Taking that temperature.
He's not doing nothing. He's doing what he can, but I don't know. This is why a guy like Amos would follow Holden, right? Because he understands the bigger picture here. And even though he loves Naomi, he's got to make the right call here. But he puts Alex and Bobby on it, which I like.
And there's a lot of just like little touches. Like, I like the mutual understanding of like the dawning realization of how close they are together, and like Bobby pointing out, oh, the Rossi's not on Tycho Station, like almost simultaneous as Jim Holden's like, we're not on Tycho Station anymore.
It
feels like that stuff, like a lot of times writers don't include things like that, kind of like those little funny coincidences and things, but it makes the writing seem so much more realistic when you have a little bit of that kind of messy stuff happening.
It makes the world feel real. Like, I can imagine scenarios like that happening all the time with this delay, right?
Oh, yeah.
It goes back to scenes like Avasarala trying to communicate with Arjun way back in like season one or something. I don't know. It was ages ago, and they're speaking over each other, and they don't know like how long the delay is, and it's painful, right? It's annoying. It's like a Zoom call times 50 or a million.
It's
unnatural.
It's unnatural. Like, you know, having like opening up a letter feels natural, and having a face-to-face conversation feels natural. A conversation with like a 3-second delay is just weird for everybody because it's that uncanny valley between the two, you know, one-way communication, two-way communication. Yeah, I think it's great, and I love when they lean into that kind of stuff. And in a similar vein, I also like how they introduce, like, you know, underline Bobby's toughness because she's, like, casually picking out a bullet from, like, her Under Armour, you know. And Alex is like, oh, my God, you got shot? She's like, oh, yeah, loads of times. Which, again, Bobby, I don't know, maybe take cover. Maybe not let your armor tank every single round. But she's just like, just itches and it flings it and the gravity shoves it back. I just like how kind of cavalier she is about that stuff.
Yeah.
So it does seem like they're setting up the promise, because after the Zemea gets destroyed in this episode, I imagine that Holden and Alex and Bobby are going to link up.
Yeah.
Holden, that because they're keeping tabs on, so they're going to, I don't know, like I said, I'm really curious to see what happens next week with this whole Chainsmoker plot, because I just don't see it because they make it abundantly clear that if you think the Ross and I is going to go in there and like it's going to out badass these Russian frigates and destroyers and cruisers, like everyone who is in the know in this show is like, we are outgunned, we are outnumbered, this is not going to happen.
Yeah.
Having the Chainsmoker and a Screaming Firehawk on their side, I don't think changes that equation any more than Drummer having three ships changed it for her.
Yeah, they meet up with Drummer, I don't think it changes the equation, right? There isn't enough firepower in the vicinity to defeat Marco's warships.
It feels like it's going to come down to, like, I don't know, maybe a Drummer holding Bobby Alex fleet with a little bit of inside help from Sin and Philip is the way that these things are going to go down. Because, like, yeah, it just doesn't seem like you're going to have a conventional rescue operation that's going to have success. But we'll see.
Mildly interesting.
Naomi runs into Sin and the mess. He's coming back from, I think, the Chainsmoker, doing some work on that ship, he has moved to confess to his complicity in kidnapping Philip and hiding him from her, and has just a real emotional confrontation with her.
Yeah, it's devastating. Man, you feel for everybody involved in this situation. He thought he was doing the right thing at the time. Now he's come to regret his decision. You know, not just because of what's happened with Marco, right, and how this whole thing has sort of spiraled out and has become bigger than he wanted it to be, but personally with Naomi, he felt like he broke that family up. He's almost personally responsible in a way for it, so yeah, it's pretty devastating, and that guy's great.
He is great, and the scene is, I was surprised at how emotionally effective I thought it was, and the fact that, like, he's been stewing over guilt in almost exactly the same way that Naomi has, just from opposite sides of it. Like, he thought he was doing something to keep his family together, and in fact, you hear this all the time, you know, like people, fathers and mothers doing over heavy-handed things that they think is going to make their kids do something that ends up pushing them away, and then they have regrets, and like seeing this, and also like Naomi didn't know any of this stuff, her coming to grips with this betrayal from a father figure, and how like she went from like this grief stricken to like just hard as a bag of cement with like, well, guess what? It's not too late. You can redeem yourself and you can do it by helping me. What does that look like? Especially when I kind of think Sin's dead at the end of this episode.
Oh yeah. 100%. Like nobody was moving to close that airlock.
Right. Yeah. But that's exchange where, you know, he says, I'm so sorry. And she says, I thought you loved me. And he's like, I loved all of us. We were a family. Powerful stuff.
Yeah.
So I think one of the standout scenes in the episode. And we go to Monica trying to probe Holden, in perhaps many senses of that word, about his involvement in the protomolecule sample, as well as Naomi's connection to Marco's terrorist group, when Bull barges in and tells him that the hunt for the Zemea is on.
So this is the scene in the cafeteria, the mess, whatever it is, with Holden and Monica, where she essentially, I think, lays out the case that that we've been wondering about, where like the dream for Mars could still be alive. I think like the combination of the protomolecule scientist and a sample of the protomolecule is potentially able to rebuild worlds if you use it correctly, right? They've seen what it can do.
Yeah, super terraformer, perhaps.
I could see Savater, you know, wanting to get his hands on that so that the quote-unquote dream of Mars can live on. Even if it's being evacuated, right? They might not need the people if the protomolecule can do it themselves. Or, you know, not even necessarily physically on Mars, but that Martian dream can live on somewhere else with the protomolecule.
Yeah, and So my only problem with that, and of course this isn't, you know, obviously we're not getting this right from the Admiral himself. This is like Monica's speculation, but like if I would offer an alternative way to look at that, like I don't know that the Martians would consider an easy button for terraforming Mars to be the dream of Mars, because it does seem like they feel like there is something about this, you know, they're kind of like a more militant version of the Belters ethos of like, you know, all for one, you know, or one for all, rather, kind of like communal responsibility, hard work like this. It's the process, the hard work of terraforming Mars is what makes a Martian a Martian. That shared dream, the cooperation, but the hard work and the delayed gratification, the planting trees that you will not feel the shade of for future generations, that kind of thing that like is the antithesis of like the selfishness, quick results driven, quick fix kind of way that we always view things, the quarterly way that we kind of view things on Earth. And if you can just have like, oh, well, okay, we're gonna get the protomolecule sample and Kotazar, and he's gonna reprogram it to where we can terraform Mars in like 5 months, doesn't that destroy the dream of Mars? Because if it's easy, that's Earther. And, you know, being an Earther is kind of like seen as a problem. It's a mindset, not like a political affiliation. So I don't know. I still feel like that there might be something else. And especially now that at the end of the episode, I think the protomolecule is off the board forever. At least that's my read on the situation. I don't know what that means. Maybe Mars just gets screwed then.
I don't know, because the Zamea, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't the Zamea meet up with a group of ships before this? Haven't they already up with a group? Maybe I'm wrong, because I know Holden says, like, oh, if they meet up with someone.
He says something like there's multiple contacts, but I thought it was more of like they're trying to find Zamea out of all the possible things it could be.
Right, know? And they're in the shipping lanes, and it's... Right.
Yeah, you don't want to just blow the drive cone out from some civilian freighter or something.
Right.
And they're not they're going dark, so you don't have the drive cone so you have to do a lot of careful kind of like analysis work. But I kind of thought that there might be, but okay.
I was kind of thinking too that
there might be but like the way that Marco reacts to destruction of it seems like he's real pissed.
Yeah.
Like, you know, not just he lost a ship, but like this was a big thing that he needed and they fucked it up for him. So,
yeah. So I guess that means he's not probably going to be getting any more ships. And this might be the extent of the Free Navy as far as the Martian ships are concerned. So
interesting.
Hold on to these things, right? Like you got nine or so of them, whatever.
So it's kind of like an analogy to like the fleet that Japan had at the beginning of World War II. It's very impressive, but they don't have the industrial capacity to just replace those things. So it's like they lose a carrier. That's something that like, oh shit, they're not going to get that back before the war's over.
Right.
Cutting Marco off though, he can't just get ships willy nilly. Yeah, it's a significant and a powerful fleet, but he can't just, you know, commit them to battle and lose them and act like that he can get more the way that perhaps Earth and Mars could.
And it's another personal affront, you know, if taking his girl wasn't enough, Marco is going to be pissed that he's now single-handedly destroying his plan. Like Holden seems to be everywhere in the system that is important at any given moment, right? He's he's at the center of every single big battle, which is, they've made it pretty plausible that he might be in those scenarios, but also Jesus Christ, if you're Marco and Holden's just going around the system, swatting down your plan left and right,
mm-hmm.
it, it seems like the gods are not on your side, right? If the Belters believe in any gods, holy shit, they're on Holden's side.
Yeah, you know, you can hurl rocks at Earth with impunity and steal this vast fleet from Mars, but this one dude and this one stolen Martian thing is just completely stymieing you everywhere he goes. Yeah. No, he does not like that, clearly. In fact, the next scene is Marco being very unhappy about his reversals of fortune and taking it on Sin, blaming him for his son's sudden sympathy with his mother and encouraging of what he perceives as his son's weakness. He just blasts him.
He does. But before we get too far away from the last scene, I do want to know, Holden talks about this message that he found from Naomi that was meant for him if she doesn't return. I really want to know what's in that message, but I also really want Naomi to come back. So I'm like torn between, I mean, obviously the better outcome here is Naomi returns and they continue her story.
It is for a viewer, it's getting a little frustrating for me that, like, you know, we see Holden get the message and open it, but the camera cuts before we get to it. And he goes to Monica. It's like, you know, before last thing, I got this suicide switch message from Naomi in case things go wrong. Bull comes running in and interrupts him. Like, come on. You either tell me what's in this thing or fuck off. Like, this is getting to be a little bit of like, what did the doctor whisper into Rick's ear in The Walking Dead kind of situation.
Well, like,
the longer you keep it from me, the more I don't give a shit, you know?
Fair. It hasn't been that long, but I don't think Holden knows what's in the message. I don't think Holden read it. He's the guy that doesn't read this message until he knows.
Is it possible that I think it's interesting, a concept of what is it possible Naomi's pregnant? Or wait, they said that Holden can't have children because of
the radiation, right?
Radiation thing. Because I'm trying to think of like what would be the interesting thing for them to keep? Like what would be the emotional charge thing that I don't know. I can't imagine at this point, since he knows where Naomi is, he knows where his ship is, he knows the surrounds. She's kind of like, what extra information could it be? It has to be entirely personal or emotional. And what would be kind of worth keeping from us? A miracle baby, you know, that they're going to have some kind of miracle proto molecule baby. Was that the last thing that Miller did when he was fucking with Holden's brain and molecular structure? He like fixed his testicles.
Sure. You know,
let me clean out your pipes, kid, before I go.
Wow. I seriously doubt it. I don't think it's going to be anything magical like that, but who knows?
We'll see. So the Rossi finally gets down to the business of chasing down the Zemea. We get some quality close combat quarters, space battle porn as the two ships fight for their lives. Unfortunately for Holden's hopes of getting some information from the ship about Naomi, the ship explodes before they can be boarded. What the fuck? And what does this mean for the protomolecule sample?
Good questions. I also have two questions. Is the spin necessary? I know it looks cool. I know it's awesome to see those PDC rounds spiraling out away from the Rossi, but it's got guns on all sides. Do you really need to spin the ship?
I want to spin. Hey, if you got something, you spin it. You got a drum, you spin it. You got a ship, you spin it. That's what's in space. That's what you do. You spin shit. Yeah. I wonder if it is kind of like, a standard practice in 24th century battle to start a spin on your ship, because if you lose a thruster, if you keep it spinning, you can like by like the same way that like Alex brought the bucking Rocinante in to kind of control with the orbital shenanigans of last season. If you lose a PDC, you don't have like you're already in a position for the because the computer don't give a fuck. Oh, one more axis of spin to account for it doesn't. So I wonder if it's like kind of. Like some kind of standard operating procedure just to keep all the capabilities brought to bear to rotate damage around. They've never done it before,
flip
though.
It, too. I want to see it. I just want to see it tumbling
around.
Six
axes. The full. And the thing is, it reminded me so much of you and I a couple years ago live watched The Last Starfighter. The Death Blossom sequence.
Uh-huh.
This reminded me so much of the Death Blossom sequence, like this ballet of torpedoes spiraling in and the Rocinante twirling and all those tracer rounds sending like all these spirals of death and lead outward. I thought it was beautiful and awesome and impressive.
Firing the railgun was awesome too. Like I kind of like the angle they gave us of the railgun powering up and then firing.
Plus the railgun to me is a little bit maybe a little bit too science fiction-y. Yeah. Like the purple plasma venting off of it screams Halo to me. Like,
yeah, I don't know why there would be colored anything coming off of this. It's just accelerating a tungsten round or whatever.
It's the opposite of what they do with the PDCs, where those just look like, you know, almost like just kind of scaled up, more sophisticated versions of what they already have on terrestrial ships right now, anti, you know, missile capabilities and stuff.
I mean, it would just be some electromagnetic. Right.
Imagine if the PDCs looked like Star Wars pew pew lasers. Like, it would kind of, that'd be cool, but it's kind of less cool than the gritty, realistic. Like, this is just high velocity lead being slung around. I feel like the railgun's the same way. Like, it'd be more impressive if it just, like, hey, you know, it's slinging this extremely heavy, dense protocol at fractional the speeds of the light. Mm-hmm. It doesn't need, like, this purple vapor coming off of it for me to sell how deadly it is. Like, the Rocinante going backwards in its thrust, taking this thing out, tells me everything I need to know. Minor criticism, though. Someone, you know, just like you shouldn't be able to hear any of this shit in space, someone decided that, you know, we need some purple plasma coming off of the coils to really sell that this is a sexy, sexy weapon.
Do you remember what it looked like when they fired the railgun in orbit of Illus last season?
I didn't think it was this fancy, but maybe it was.
It. Yeah. Yeah. I can't even tell you if they showed it or not.
It's been
a while.
But that's the difference between going through something episode by episode where you can actually talk about all the things that you love and bother versus just kind of like, you know, because we kind of just did a couple episodes that encompassed the entire thing because of the release schedule last year.
My other questions. Did the Zamea blow itself up intentionally or did it accidentally blow itself up trying to escape?
I think them like frantically saying shut down the reactor, shut down. Like, it seems to me that they were under orders to not be boarded by any means necessary.
Yeah.
Why do you think that Bull and Monica found it so controversial that he wanted to board the ship rather than just kill the pro? Because, like, I mean, this ship is helpless. Like, it'd be one thing if he failed to take out the drive cone or whatever, but, like, once the ship was stopped, they could be boarded or blow up. Either way, the proto molecule would be secure or destroyed. Why do you think that they were so...
Are there instances of ships being counter boarded? Like you put your, you attach to the ship, you dock with it and you go to board and then your ship is overrun and taken. Cause like, that's the only way I could see this being a real problem.
Yeah. But if you send drones, there's no way that could happen. We know that Rocinante has combat drones to do it. So like, if it's like some Trojan horse and Marco's got 200 team of crack ghost knife trained belters ready to come and do wet work on the... Yeah,
right.
Because, you know, they're only like, what, 15, 20 people in the Rocinante?
And they're probably like the engineers and shit. Like, these aren't highly trained soldiers on Tycho Station,
it's nothing but spider bots in there.
There you go.
It's 200 highly trained and armored spider bots just coming to wreck your shop. But yeah,
Rossi. They can't be highly trained soldiers. There's no way.
No, you're right. Oh yeah, you're right. They are just like, you know, the most trustworthy of Fred Johnson's crew, not necessarily from security or whatnot.
Yeah, maybe they've heard of Doors and Corners. That's about the best you can hope for.
But I felt like it was like, I don't know. So high chance of upside of getting intelligence and finding out the location, Naomi, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Very low chance of downside. But I guess almost any downside involving the protomolecule is like such a huge, almost infinite risk that maybe it's not worth it. But, you know, it's Holden's ship and he got to make the call. And it seems like, again, I think the protomolecule is just off the board, at least the sample, which I don't know what that means for Cortazar now. Like, also, I guess that thing was in like some kind of armored sleeve. And I would believe that maybe if you put that into some kind of container inside the ship, that it could survive the destruction, the gross destruction of the ship. Like, there's wreckage and things. Like, I don't know.
Maybe.
We'll see. This thing has changed hands a lot, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Maybe they ejected it. I wonder if, like, oh, the other thing they could do, what if they just threw it out the airlock with a location tag and they shot all those torpedoes at the Rocinante to distract them from that? You know?
Yeah. Boy, how are they going to communicate that? Like,
type beam to Marco.
No, I mean to us. They can't type beam us as an audience.
Oh, and Marco just, all he has to do is next, it's like when Philip's like, oh, father, I'm sorry for losing the protomolecule. Oh, about that, you stupid son of a bitch. My crew, my faithful, loyal crew threw it out the airlock and gave me a transponder code for it. And here's its orbit around the solar system. We're going to go get it. Like, yeah, I mean, they do shit like that all the time. It wouldn't bother me.
Okay.
Speaking of emotional abusing your son, Philip wants to step up and prove his worth, not just to his father, but the people of the belt. But Marco decides to cruelly smack his son down and humiliating him before puffing him up with some promises of delayed future delusions of grandeur. Having his crew chant his name. What do you make of this?
I feel like this is the first half of this where he's tearing Philip down is largely a result of Naomi getting under his skin, and then Holden, you know, he's pissed at Holden taking out his protomolecule. Like, this is the insecure part, the shittiest part of Marco coming out on his own side
of the narcissist. Yeah.
Yeah, man. It's rough to watch. You really like put yourself in Philip's shoes in this moment, and he's like trying to step up. He's got this newly revitalized fervor for their mission, and he's trying to do what he can to help, and his dad comes in and just shits all over him. And then, you know, maybe Philip, this makes Philip feel a little bit better about this whole situation, but this is the grossest part when he builds him back up, right? Because you know he's not doing it because he wants Philip to feel good about himself. He's doing it because he needs Philip to manipulate later. He knows that Philip is one of his tools and that he's going to continue using him, and therefore he can't crush Philip's spirit. He wants to keep that tool in his toolbox.
And this is anti-Belter. Like, I don't think the Belters want to be ruled by a monarchy, which is kind of what he's promising here. It's like, I'm the man and everyone knows it, and I'm the ones whose names get chanted, but soon you'll have your time.
Mm-hmm.
After I'm gone.
Yeah.
Well, so yeah, like, are the Belters signed up for like a monarchy, you know?
No.
Going to be ruled by Philip of Macedonia. It's a reverse Philip and Alexander situation. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
it's gross. I felt real bad for Philip in this scene.
Yeah, me too.
Naomi is summoned to the bridge so Marco can let her go out an airlock after her son and he used the chain smoker to lure Holden and the Rocinante to their deaths. You know what? Naomi, she doesn't take it too well. She's got one trick. It's called go to the airlock and throw herself out of it. And she's going to try it again.
Yeah, it works on Sin. Man, there's this moment where she's taken to the bridge of the Pella. And, you know, she realizes what's happening here. She looks over to Sin and he just turns around in his chair. And I wish they had lingered a little bit more on Sin, gave us like a moment where you could like see him, you know, like processing what he's doing, like maybe even just to his back, right? Not a close up or anything, but like we see him maybe weeping over there in the corner or something, but maybe that's not this him. Maybe that's too weak, but guy, it felt like this was a huge moment, him turning his back on Naomi, and I wanted a little bit more.
I actually was geared up for some kind of subterfuge because whole like you have to help me. The fact I thought that you're going to find out that like Philip and Sin and Naomi had some kind of plan working together. I thought it was also so they take Naomi back to the brig, I think. Presumably. But yet they let her and they shut her in this door, but she's free to move about the ship, which seems kind of foolish by Marco. But maybe in his grandiosity, he forgot to rescind that order. But I thought when kind of Sin was looking shifty and going to this panel that he was actually going to like unlock her door or something along those effects. It doesn't look like that's it. He just like wanted to locate her to make sure that she didn't throw herself out of an airlock like she's doing.
But I thought that was the point. Yeah,
I thought that was what?
Like, isn't Marco going to space her?
I'm going to kill Holden. And once you see him defeated, I'm going to put you on the float, which has always been throw you out an airlock with or without a spacesuit and leave you there to die.
So, I'm not sure why Sin is so concerned about this, because that's her eventual fate anyway, right? Whether she does it or whether Marco does it. But also,
but Sin in the airlock talks a mess about, I can fix this with Marco. Like, as long as you're still alive, I can fix. I think he thinks that. And I think Philip does too, because I don't think Philip's going to be cool. Yeah. Like, Philip thinks that maybe if they take Holden off the table, then my Walla loving mom will see the wisdom and staying with her real family. Like, I think I see the percentage and all that, but like, if Sin's dead, it will bother me a little bit, because I think that he doesn't need to do anything, but the complete kind of his arc and what he's on, like, I felt like he needs to do something to help Naomi. Or at least that's what I was expecting.
I think it's too late.
I think he's dead. Yeah, he's going limp. He absolutely, like, and here's the other thing. I got a question. I don't know that in the pop culture it's penetrated that the vacuum of space is not as lethal as we were taught as children. Like, I grew up thinking that as soon as you, like, crack your helmet, you instantly die and freeze over. Like, you're dipped in liquid nitrogen.
You turn inside out sure.
It turns out a hard vacuum is an incredibly effective insulator. One of the reasons your Yeti cup will keep ice cold for 24 hours is because it's holding a vacuum where you can no longer, by convection, lose heat. You have to radiate it. One of the banes of the International Space Station and all spaceships' existence is losing waste heat. They have to have massive surface areas to radiate the heat because they can literally overheat in space. It would take a body hours or days to actually freeze solid out in space, going from body temperature to, like, slowly bleed off until, yeah, you eventually go to like just a few degrees above absolute zero.
Yeah.
But it would take a very long time to get there because space, again, is an excellent insulator. And turns out humans also don't just, like, completely black out instantly. You know, you can't hold your breath in space. But you do have, like, you let it out now if you wanted to, like, let all your air out. And, you know, you probably have 10, 15 seconds before you even feel like you have to breathe again. And you probably, if you had to, could have 30 seconds or so of usable consciousness. And they introduced with Monica the concept of the hyper-oxygenated blood.
Right. And which is that hypo spray thing that she uses, injection.
I want to explain that just to make sure people made that connection. That is, I presume, the hyper oxygenated blood that she boosted from the infirmary that gives her, just as her vision's turning to red, which I think it technically would probably turn to black. But that gives her last, and the rest of the stuff, like, I liked it. Felt very realistic to what actually happens when people are exposed to vacuum. Like, you saw the liquids on her eyes boiling away, because that would absolutely happen. You know, starting to see some frost into things that would freeze over quickly, like her hair and her eyelashes. The capillaries in exposed areas, especially things like delicate things like structure, starting to rupture from the lack of pressure. Mm-hmm. I thought this is actually a very realistic depiction of what would happen to you if you're exposed to hard vacuum.
I wish they had made the Chet Smoka look a little closer, because they make it look really far away, and I don't know which ships are moving and which directions. They're clearly floating away. I have a hard time buying that she could push off hard enough to actually make it in any reasonable amount of time to the Chet Smoka, but...
Like 30 seconds ago, they were mated together and they're slowly drifting apart, but they're still in, like, some kind of flying formation. I thought it was just... They did everything they needed to make it believable to where I think that could actually happen.
Okay.
It was like a one in a million thing, and there's a lot of things that could go wrong, but, like, I do believe that... But that's the thing, is, like, if you're... If you don't know these kind of like the modern findings we found out about humans' exposure to vacuum, you might, like, if you all you know is Arnold Schwarzenegger in
on
Total Recall,
Mars, yeah,
face exploding, or who was the guy in Mission to Mars? I forget the guy who, like, you know, opened his helmet and instantly froze. Like, if that's your pop culture experience with space, then you might this might surprise you, but. It's pretty realistic. But I assume Sin is dead because, you know, he's out there in a vacuum of space. He's clearly gone unconscious. And no one is shutting the door to save him is the big thing. I wonder if the door won't shut because his arm is like breaking the plane or something.
I assumed that I don't know. Is it fair to call that just like a poetic vision sort of thing? Like he's reaching out to Naomi as he's dying and he like stays frozen there. That's the last we see him.
Yeah, he's forever yearning to make that connection. Yeah, no, no, it's pretty poignant.
I feel like they're doing a lot with that and I'm not quite getting the point of it. But, you know, I feel the emotion of it, certainly. Can I just ask you, I thought the first time I watched this episode that it was very sloppy. There was a lot of stuff that I didn't think
made a lot of sense.
Second time through, almost all of those problems have been taken off the board. I think they did a very good job with it. The one, maybe I should mention how in the past episode, maybe two episodes, we talked about how we weren't sure what Philip meant when he said, hey, you should be happy that I saved you or I saved your life or whatever. I thought that it meant when he called Naomi there, he was removing her from the Rocinante, which they expected to blow up when it took off. And that's what he meant by saving her life. In this episode, they make it very, very clear. Marco says a couple of times that Naomi, you know, had attempted to kill him. And that was your position, is that he was talking about the knife that she had brought to the bridge to try and kill Marco. That's what he did, is saving her by taking her off the bridge. I guess I'm a little confused. I'm a little up in the air. We talked about this on the live stream last night on the watch party.
I felt like the satisfying answer, at least for me, is that we were both right. That Philip saw that she tried to kill her father with the knife. And he was also saying, you should thank me for saving you because I took you off the Rocinante and you'd be dead. So that lets Naomi have a realization, but also because you're right. Like even the last episode, Marco is ranting and raving about her almost killing him. You know, she tried to do this. And this episode, he repeats it. So he knows that there was the attempt on his life.
Yeah. I like that we could both be right. That neither of us could have the full picture. You know, maybe this is a learning moment. We're having a learning moment here on the Expanse podcast. Two people can have different views on something and still both of them be right.
Yeah, because you're saying it's like sloppy. Well, is it? Because like you guys talked me into your way of viewing it, but I also very strongly had that, like watching that episode twice, really had the strong intuition that Philip did see the knife and did know that he was trying to kill. So like that allows me to like, okay, then now it all kind of like both of those things track. So because I thought this, I'm sorry.
No, sorry. I was just going to say the thing that I still see in this episode that seems a little bit sloppy is this idea that Naomi is somehow roaming around the ship still and that she would have access to this airlock. Like the last time we saw Naomi, she was being carted off by two security officers or whatever, it's a black sky, golden bow, whatever they are, and shoved into, presumably into a cell to be held so that she can watch the Rocinante blow up and then be spaced. Why would they ever allow her out of that cell?
That's the one thing that like is a little bit of a problem for me, because I thought like if Sin did something to help her get out. Or, you know, also Naomi's brilliant and she's been serving aboard a Martian ship for years now. Like, I think that she could MacGyver her way. Like, you know, like Marco doesn't know these. None of these belters know these ships. Like, they can't even fucking change the air filters without knowing the tricks of the trade. So I thought she was going to, like, pull off some random panel, stick her toothbrush into some kind of thing and just, like, jimmy the door. And she probably could have done that at any time. But now is, like, her time to take action. And maybe you're supposed to understand that, like, that's probably what she did.
No,
but
you got
to
show me that.
I think you need to show. I need a 5-second insert of her pulling a bobby pin out of a pocket that she palmed the while she was in. Or they could have, even if they just said an insert of, like, when she was talking to Sin over the table, he had his toolkit there. Like, it just a 3-second of her palming something from that. And then another insert of her pulling it out of her pocket when they shove her in the brig. That's all they needed to do. And I felt like there was a scene or two missing, because otherwise, the other thing I guess is I believe that Marco is a bit sloppy. Like, he is a pretty, he's pretty brilliant, but he's just one man. He's got limited resources. His whole plan almost got fucked up because he threw the rock just a little bit too close to the sun. This could be just him being arrogant and thinking that, you know, he's broke Naomi again. Because, you know,
well, they didn't.
Philip
they didn't
slapping her was all. We didn't talk about that, but Philip slapping her was a fucking moment.
Yeah, it was.
That was like rock, like that. And Dominic played that so well, her being so wounded and hurt, thinking that she had made progress, this connection, and now her son has gone right back to the default of, like, you're everything that I'm not, and you're a earth-loving well-walla, and you're nothing like me and my father. Like, that's like, he just snaps back to that thing so hard. That maybe Margot's arrogant enough that he thinks that, like, yeah, I'm going to break her again. And she
they didn't make
do
that point either. I don't think they did really. Right by this part this plot point at all, which is rare. It's a rare complaint I have about The Expanse that they don't connect dots like this.
Yeah. Now, the only thing I could say is, like, I don't feel that quite that strong, but, like, I suspect that as a book reader, maybe things went down a little bit different in a more satisfying way.
This is all more satisfying. Really? The character-wise, Naomi is night and day.
Well, shit.
In this.
Shit,
she's
then.
So much
know.
Better in the show than she is in the book.
Well, there you go. I do think this is kind of a cliffhanger because, as I pointed out in the beginning of the episode, so she's on the Chainsmoker. Great. You are right next to one of the more powerful warships in the galaxy, in the solar system. They have also said that the Chainsmoker has got zero utility to this fleet. It's just a civilian ship. What does she do now? Like, it's set the remote pilot to do some mission, but clearly they could just undo that. And if Naomi's able to undo their undoing, they can just blow her out of the sky. Like, in what universe is she able to do something that will matter?
And they've already established that it's not as easy as Holden swooping in and saving her, right?
Right, because he's out and outnumbered and outgunned in this situation, and not even that really close. Like, this is something, like, you know, Marcos is 3 football fields from her. I don't know where Holden is, but he's a lot further away than that. So, like, how does this help the situation?
Well,
the only thing I can think
mean,
of
I...
is Philip. Like, Philip must be his. He must his. Like, I yeah. love to see his reaction because. He thought it was disturbing when, like, Sin and his father went toe-to-toe. Sin just blew himself out of an airlock to try to save his mom. His mom is such a badass. She, like, Princess Leia'd her way, you know, interstellar. Did interstellar travel without a vac suit, all to thwart his father. Like, I could see him just being like, if you kill my mother, I'm going to, I don't know, hold my breath until I turn blue. I'm going to throw myself out of an airlock or something. Something that makes Marco compromise his position. And maybe that's what they're counting on. Also, I guess I believe that Sin can also come back. Like, if Monica can die in a vacuum and they shove the hyperoxygenated blood in her stream and bring her back, I guess they could do that to Sin too. Maybe Sin, now seeing history repeat itself, will do some kind of sabotage to keep it them from chasing after it. I don't know. Also, Sin was one of the ones on the Chainsmoker. Mm-hmm. That was doing the rigging of it to be automated. It's possible that he put some kind of backdoor that could bite Marco in the ass that he doesn't know about too. But it's not a cliffhanger. It's like, is Naomi going to die? It's like, well, what's she going to do now? You know, she successfully moved from the frying pan into the fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now what?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I can't say too much. I guess, like, I have a question for you. What do you think is the purpose of the Chainsmoker at this point? Is it like, what do you think Marco is trying to do with it?
He said he's going to lure Holden. Like, I guess my thought was that he was going to make it seem like Naomi had commandeered the ship and was like getting like escaping, and that would make, you know, Holden have to come and do some kind of, and like then they're outnumbered and outgunned and they'll just cut the Rocinante to pieces.
Yeah, I guess what he doesn't count on is that Holden knows he's outgunned, because that's the thing, right? Like, he doesn't,
that's true.
Marco doesn't know that Alex and Bobby have spotted the fleet and that they have relayed that information to Holden, so Holden is very wary.
which is the great thing about what the show does do well, is to show all the asymmetric nature of war, of yeah. information and warfare, that like, oh, they don't know the things that I know they know, and they don't know they know. They think I'm just some lone belter pirate out here. I got a whole fleet of warships and even drones. Yeah, that so that that's but now Holden knows what he doesn't know. He knows. And so, yeah, it's I honestly have no idea. And I can't wait to see the next episode, because I'm trusting that there's some satisfying answers, that it's not going to make me just like throw my hands up and be like, OK, well, you know, although I will say that, like, I extend one or two of those branches to every show, because I think it's really hard to tell a tight knit narrative. And every once in a while, you kind of have to go down a patch of old, muddy, gravel, ill-maintained road to get back every once in a while. You know, I've done it with Breaking Bad. I've done it with Game of Thrones. I did it until I ran out of
their path home.
Yeah, I got lost down that gravel road to Game of Thrones. But I will for good shows like this, I will give them a dusty trail or two to follow, where I have to make a couple logical leaps. But
yeah,
the more it would disappoint me if they start leaning on that over much, and I don't think they will.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping. You've been listening to quite a few Bald Move podcasts now, but you're not in the club? Whoo boy, you are missing out.
Not only are all of our premium club podcast feeds completely ad-free, but we have lots of other great content exclusively for people in the club.
There's a weekly lunch with Jim and Aaron where we chat with fans about anything and everything from TV and films, food, fun, life advice, and more.
But there's also Off the Clock, our premium podcast where we talk about all the shows we don't have time for on our public feeds.
Plus, you get access to our full spoiler-filled first-run movie reviews of our newly released films.
Don't forget Instant Take and Talk podcast, where we give our hot takes and discuss television shows with our fans live and immediately after the episode airs.
With mega shows like House of the Dragon coming this summer, we're going to have lots to talk about.
Not to mention access to our fun and friendly community of club members, with exclusive Discord channels and a dedicated forum. It's one of the best places on the internet to hang out and chat about pop culture.
Bottom line, you're helping two regular type guys in the Midwest make the content you like to listen to, which some would say is reward unto itself.
Help keep the lights on and the bits flowing at Bald Move.
And get some awesome content for yourself. Head to support.baldmove.com to join the club today.
All right, I think that's it for the episode. We've got some feedback, a little bit of stuff from the previous episode that we're going to consider here. We start off with TB says, "Hello again, fellas. As far as much of your speculation goes," he specifically mentions like this Russian wheat production in the Path of Revolutions that you were talking about last episode. As someone who's eagerly awaiting the final book, all I can say is mildly interesting. One thing I can certainly say,
I'll take this from Jim, not you guys too.
Oh yeah. One thing I can certainly say is that the Corys, the James essays, have been pretty upfront about what informs their vision of the future. And that is predominantly the past. They certainly have the view that humanity doesn't really change much and that we repeat a lot of the same patterns and cycles. Or as Mark Twain said, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes.
First time is tragedy, the second time is comedy or farce. I can't remember the exact quote.
Not a big Mark Twain guy, but sure. One thing that isn't talked much about regarding the success the U.S. had in the insurgency in Iraq in the mid-2000s, lots of ink was spilled about troop surges, and apparently he was in the middle of it. But the truth was that things only really turned when the Iraqis had enough of the insurgents themselves. That's often one of the best ways to deal with the likes of Marco. Eventually, you give them time, they'll hang themselves. Because for all his talk, Marco doesn't actually want equality. He wants to be the new oppressor. He doesn't want to break the wheel. He just wants to be on top. More often than not, these guys have to be so brutal and totalitarian to enforce their visions that they eventually end up self-sabotaging.
Yeah, they turn their own people against them.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And man, you see that, especially like the microcosm here is Philip and Marco, right? The more he tries to tighten his hold, it's the Princess Leia. Let's get two references in here for Leia and Tarkin, right?
Right, yeah. And it's also, that's interesting because now looking back, I see so much how much the fingerprints are all over that. Like when they go show the first colony, it plays out so much like colonization in the past, except for you don't have like a native population. I guess the Belters would be the native population on Illus/Newterra. But like immediately all the same. And it's almost like it's not because it had to be that way, but everyone took those preconceptions into the situation with them. The Belters, like, oh my god, here comes this corporation to come oppress us. Murtry, here's these murderous Belters that want to kill us all. They need to, you know, I got there's no civilization out here, so I have to be brutal. It's the only way. Like, and now you've got like this kind of Cold War zealot rejection of you know, bourgeoisie science, you know, what the fuck your biosphere. That's all a bunch of bullshit. We just mix our shit together. We all saw The Martian. Just get your shit buckets out, mix it up with the dirt. You're going to be fine. I think it's a great way to tell the story. And man, like, it's funny because like human history right now seems hell bent to kind of like prove some of the points that they were making about us like being doomed to repeat history, because it does feel like, god damn, it does feel like we're just going through the 1920s all over again.
Yeah,
hopefully we can make a little bit of progress and change, but who knows.
That's the thing, I mean, when you look at why things repeat, why history repeats itself and rhymes, it's because humans don't change very much, you know, in the aggregate. It's hard to really say that the things that people want, the things that motivate people, things that make people angry, feel, you know, oppressed or feel valued, all of those things are pretty constant. And of course things are going to play out similarly because none of those things have changed.
You try to teach people history, but like it does seem like once the people that had firsthand experience for when things run off the rails die off, everyone starts thinking like, ah, was it really that bad? Or, oh, was this thing really that good? Or, you know, times that's the mechanism right there that causes it to repeat, you know?
I mean, that's part of it. And it's why like education is so important, right? Just knowing about things that have happened and seeing how they happened and why they happened can kind of, if not change how you feel about a thing, at least give you the perspective to stand back and say, am I repeating these patterns? And that's true of like history at large. That's true of your own life. If you're not actively learning about who you are and who humanity is as a species, I feel like you're doing everyone a disservice, right? And most of all, yourself.
Yeah, and it's also the difference between like a student of history and a history buff. You know, you can be like a Civil War buff or a World War II buff, and you know everything about the Wehrmacht and the Panzer tank. And like Marco kind of strikes me as a history buff. He knows a lot about Alexander the Great and ancient conquerors of antiquity and idolizing that, but like other lessons that might be equally pertinent to, you know, building his cause and building a great nation for the belt, maybe lost on him.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on to Bill D. He says, on rewatching The Expanse with my wife, one thing that really impresses me is just how much foreshadowing there's been all along. And he gives a couple of examples. In season one, episode one, it's the first episode of the series for people who are following, Avasarala, whoever tortures and interrogates
Chrissy.
Chrissy tortures and interrogates a pretty extreme belter in possession of Martian stealth tech, which, although grounded in a season one story arc, I thought was a brilliant foreshadowing moment. Because here we are, stealth tech coming back into play in a very different way.
Mm-hmm.
Likewise, season one, episode four, Officer Rala is staged atop their house, her sari flowered around her with a terrified look on her face as she watches the stars in what looked like a meteor shower. She tells presumably her grandkid that she worries about people who that throw rocks.
Mm-hmm. Damn. Yeah. I mean, that's like that belter possessing stealth technology. That's real. That's the Marco outfit, obviously. That's like before we even knew what it was and what was going on. That was the consolidation going on behind the scenes. We thought it was all about Dawes and Fred and that battle. We didn't even know.
And the Martians and all that stuff.
Right. We didn't know what the real threat brewing.
Yeah.
And being like maybe Marco, like if Ganymede hadn't happened, what was the rock that got thrown at Eros? If Eros hadn't happened, if Mars and Earth hadn't weakened themselves in their pointless kind of proxy war, Marco probably wouldn't have been able to rise, but that happened and he did. So yeah, great points.
Mm-hmm. All right, Christina from Ohio says, got an idea of why Marco may have wanted Monica. It seemed like she might have wanted her, or he might have wanted her to document his ascension of power in a very narcissistic and personal way. He's shown that particular tick when deciding to use Naomi's code to destroy Tycho and the Rossi and all these associations with her life since she left him. Considering he planned this attack around the anniversary of his terrorist attack on the August and Gamora with Naomi's code and considers it still his greatest victory, methinks everything about his revenge and emancipation from the Inners is rather stowed in some bitter history with his ex. Yeah, man. The more I see from Marco, the more I realize that he is a very small, ego-driven man who proclaims to have all these high-minded ideals. And really, like the contributor said earlier, of most people who are in these positions, just wants to be the new oppressor. He mm-hmm. wants to inflate his own ego and be the big man in his own eyes.
And how this is very little about the belt, but more of like a vehicle for his own grandiosity. And the fact that like Naomi willingly walking away and escaping and kind of being a great figure in her own right. Mm-hmm. You know, like you imagine like how many molars must have exploded in his mouth every single time he gets a broadcast about her exploits and she's getting credit for saving the solar system and she's in this crew with this human and Martian and she's a lover of this kid. Like that must stick in his craw like a million splinters. Mm-hmm. And it's not just the betrayal to the cause. It's a personal betrayal that she saw him for what he was and, you know, really took something from him in maybe a way that no one ever has.
And he's almost using this whole he's almost using all of the belters to sort of fill that void within himself. Right. He's using an entire population of people just to make himself feel better about not being able to manipulate and control his ex-lover. Like how petty of a person could you possibly be?
Yeah, and the other thing you got to wonder about some of these extremist organizations is, do they really want to achieve the objective that they state? Because if they achieve a society of peace and order, they're not needed anymore. And people are going to start asking, like, well, how come you won't share power with not, you know, like, okay, fuck the Earthers and the Martians, but Jesus, there's other people with good ideas here. You know, we don't need to fight a war anymore, Marco. We need to expand. Why are we hungry? Your Lysenko shit's blown up in your face. So they don't want they don't want the crisis to end. You know, they don't like some minority governments out of power don't want to be back in power because then they can be blamed for shit. You know, like, oh, God, we actually have to lead effectively. It's no longer possible for us to sit and shit on things. It's no longer enough to be not the other thing. You have to actually be something else. It's tough. It's tough for demagogues and cults of personality like that to make that transition. It's why they these authoritarian, fascist, I'll even throw communist regimes in there, tend to never be at peace, because outside that, external force that they can always rally against, they don't really have a reason to justify their existence. And the need to keep oppressing people.
So Norm says, "Hey all, so Fred gets killed by insurgents, and then Holden and Bull just head off on the Rocinante. That seems like a bad idea. Doesn't the station need somebody to keep it from falling apart? Is this mildly interesting? And I'm upset the show isn't getting more love from the public. This is seriously the only show I'm making time for, and I feel like people are really missing out." Yes, they are.
Agreed. It's, sometimes you get those shows that are underappreciated in their day, and the only thing you can do is appreciate them and help other people appreciate them in a hopefully non-douchey way. But,
So everybody abandoning Tycho Station in probably its moment of need? Yeah, I feel you on that. I don't know how deep this rift runs with the crew on Tycho.
And I feel like that there was maybe a line in this episode that was addressing that, because as Bull was coming on to the thing, he was having like this angry conversation with somebody, and he's like, "Yeah, well, just tell the Tycho Corporation to bill me." Like, maybe they're kind of like, "What the fuck?" You know, like the Tycho Corporation itself is kind of like, you know, what's going on? And I just think that no one under Rocinante cares. Like, if Tycho Station gets exploded, then, I mean, I guess that would be a bummer for Holden, because where else would he go to get refitted and rebuilt and all that kind of stuff? But I don't know, because on the other hand, I don't think that Marco necessarily wanted to destroy Tycho. He wanted to kill Fred Johnson, steal the protomolecule, and embarrass, you know, this Earth and Belter kind of like unification project. But I don't know if he wanted to kill everybody. It might no longer be a target, you know, like of terrorist activity.
I
honestly haven't really thought about it until this person raised the point.
Yeah, that's fair. There's a lot of stuff I just don't think about. Importantly, though, Holden is going to go off. Like, it's asking a hell of a lot of Holden to stay on Tycho Station and try to patch things up there if he finds out that Naomi is out there under, duress, and she's in trouble. The idea that he wouldn't go out when he gets that information eventually is, I just don't buy it. He's going to go out, and he may, you know, stay on plan, but he's going to be out there in the action mixing it up. And whether Bull goes with him, I don't know. Like, it seems less likely that Bull would. It seems like maybe Bull should stay on the station. And I forget his reasoning for actually going out with Holden, but
they need a pilot. But
that's not really a reason.
Tycho's also mobile, right? Like, is it possible that Tycho's just burning like mad for the inner systems, so he can get, you know, in front of enemy lines? Because like that, maybe. I forgot that they established that like Tycho's a mobile station. Sometimes it's orbiting this, sometimes orbiting that, sometimes it's wherever it needs to be to make the supply lines work. So like, it could be that like the whole station's burning like mad to the inner core to be protected by the fleet. Because they also made the point that like one of the reasons that Tycho, you know, didn't really need beefy defenses, it doesn't have like a fleet protecting it or gun emplacements and stuff, is just because they spent so much money on the campaigns of both Earth and Mars that like anyone that raised a hand against them would be smacked down by all sides that had power.
Yeah.
But that leaves out the belt. So and Fred, I guess, handled the belt unity. So you're right. That's a big power vacuum, and the show's just kind of been like, meh, so far. So we'll see what happens.
All right, Jacob says, curious if you guys picked up on this or not, or if I'm just inflating this moment in my head, but didn't Drummer tip her hand to Marco that there was a secret recording of his plan by discussing with him the song Ashford was singing at his death? There's no way she could have known that information other than via recording. And in my last understanding, this would be new information to Marco. He should be able to easily connect the dots and realize the drummer sent the recording through to Earth, allowing Earth to prepare enough to destroy the final rocks.
I guess, but at this point, why would Marco care? Like, the plan, like Earth was smacked pretty hard. They stopped it halfway through, but still four, I believe, rocks got through. This could be kind of like, this is past that they were trying to move past. Maybe he suspected, maybe he didn't. You know, I don't know.
Is there any chance that this
didn't matter to him?
Is there any chance this comes back on him? Because, like, I remember all the stuff around Marco when they had him in the airlock and they were deciding whether or not to space him, and Ashford voted to not space him. And you had kind of all of the factions of the OPA or whatever, the Belters, out there sort of deciding on that. Is there any way this sort of turns some tide of support that Marco has against him when they find out that he spaced Ashford, the guy who showed mercy on him? I don't know. It does feel like Marco has a tenuous grasp on most of the factions, like especially Drummer, right? Like,
does it feel tenuous? Because, like, I do think that, like, he's got all these hostages. The people support him. Like, you know, you turn on these news channels and they're chanting his name, which must play great on Earth and Mars.
I think some of them are, but you look at Tycho and there are a lot who aren't. So I don't know.
There are a lot who are, but there were also a lot that were. You know, it's like, if he has 51% of the belt, then he essentially has it all, especially since the thing that he has that no one else has is this vast military. Like, he's got, like, probably at this point got to be 90% of the Belter's fleet and, like, 99% of its actual combat effective power. So would the Belters, I don't know that the Belters would give a damn that he broke his word and went against them, because that was what Ashford and Drummer kind of counting on, that, like, well, if he goes against his word and doesn't attack and brings a lot of heat, what they weren't expecting is him to, like, take out Mother Earth and just cripple it. Mm-hmm. And that's so fucking badass that, what, you know, like, almost the ends justify the means in the average Belter's eyes. So, like, I think these are political problems that are in the past, and he doesn't give a shit if, because he didn't expect Drummer to be loyal to him, like, especially after he killed, you know, Ashford. Now he expects her to be loyal because he's got her crew member and he's got the power and all that stuff. But it's not loyalty based on admiration, respect, or trust. It's loyalty based on fear and having no other choice, which, you know, and I think he's very comfortable running with 45% of his support being out of fear. I think he doesn't mind that at all.
Okay. Well, he probably needs to be on the lookout for more guys like Sin, who mm-hmm. may, you know, not have that. It's whatever it is that keeps them from rebelling. I know.
It's always the family got to watch out for, you know?
So Adam E says, "Hey guys, I've watched the series twice, most recently in preparation for season 5. And I have no recollection whatsoever of any mention or groundwork laid concerning people with genetic modifications. Am I losing my mind? Did I simply manage to miss it twice? Or did they reference this stuff in earlier seasons? Any backstory or detail you can provide on the subject, I would much appreciate, because I feel I'm missing out, specifically on Julie Mao's character development."
Julie?
Yeah, he might mean Claire. I don't know.
This has been, like, in season 1. I know it was in the books. I thought I remember. Isn't there a sequence in the show where they have, like, this series of weird bumps and incisions on Miller's neck, and the Belters recognize that, like, oh, you're a rich Belter kid because your parents were able to afford your disc fusing and bone lengthening things to make you look kind of normal and worth of, you know, and I think that's been not a huge part, because we haven't seen a lot of, like, genetically and I guess he's referring to Tiny and Clarissa and some of these extreme modifications. I just don't think we've seen a lot of that. We also know that, like, it's trivial to replace an arm, you know, because, like, some guy loses his arm in an iceberg, an ice hauling accident, and they're like, oh yeah, I'm going to get a better one. The company's going to pay for blah blah blah, and I can go for the bio replacement or I can go for the mechanical one. And, like,
when he gets those blown off,
Amos regrew his fingers. They've solved cancer with some kind of fucking pyramid thing injected. Like, this is 400 years into the future, everybody. Like, yeah, I think it's not like they just introduced this, like, in the last season or two. This has been something that's kind of been, and even if you want to say they introduced in season 3 with Clarissa Mao, like, that was the beginning, like the midpoint of season 3. That's still, like, fairly early. But yeah, I don't have any problems with that at all for those reasons.
Yeah,
and in the book, they even talk a lot more about it. Like, some parents are able to, like, if you're wealthy, you go to Ganymede, to get a little bit of, you know, to get some gravity and to get under, and or what was it, Ganon, which is the, there is a moon of either Saturn or Jupiter that has a pretty thick atmosphere in real life, and like you like pregnant women go there to like be shielded from radiation and stuff, like, you know, like it's kind of like little microcosm of, you know, things on Earth. If you have wealthy parents, you're going to be able to afford braces and best medical care, and you're going to be have a good diet, and you're going to be probably larger and stronger, have better mental acuity at school, and those advantages compound. And if you're born to poor kids in impoverished sections of the country, those disadvantages compound. And like this is like almost to a very extreme extent out and happening in the Belt. So they've definitely laid that kind of like what you use genetic modification, body modification, post kind of transhumanism stuff pretty early on, I think.
And then finally, Zeke has a couple of world questions that he was curious if we could answer. First of all, do we have a population count on each, what do we call them, race, planet, group, whatever? I think we've heard that Earth is around 30 billion. Do we know the number of Martians and Belters? I ask because Marco Adaro is killing a few million Earthers and confining both planets to their atmosphere would seem potentially detrimental to evolution and genetic diversity if Belters only number a few and want to colonize hundreds of worlds.
So genetic diversity is a problem. I know there's some populations like of animals, like I think cheetahs, people are worried about that, like they're so few and there's so, the population so inbred that they might be like right on the threshold of not having genetic diversity where they can come back to full healthy populations. But like I looked this up because I didn't know the numbers myself, and there's a, you know, a pretty nice a Wikipedia on fandom.com for The Expanse, and they list the, and I'm assuming they these are all numbers that have sources from I guess this is some of this stuff comes right, they have to the page number if you want to look this up yourself where this comes from. But Earth, the United Nations, has 24 billion people in its population. And I think that includes Earth and Luna, the moon. And the Martian Congressional Republic boasts 9 billion population of citizens, where the Belt has between 50 million and 100,000. All those numbers are sufficient to provide genetic diversity for, like that's way, 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 way more. I think I read at one point that, like, scientists think that the human species almost went extinct and was down to, like, 30 to the 60 people. That and repopulated from there. So like that's okay. Definitely enough genetic material to, you know, now if you send essentially a Winnebago full of people to a planet and it's just like, you know, two families, like you might have a little bit of inbred bullshit going on there, but like unless you do something really stupid like that, they'll be fine. I was actually shocked at the numbers here because you know, I've done a lot of like, you know, futurism reading, and like a lot of scientists think that the Earth's population, if current trends are continue, will level off somewhere between 10 and 12 billion people, because as life expectancy in a country increases, education increases, women's equality, so they can start working and providing for the family, increases, birth rates is plummet, because it's really a pain in the ass to have 12 kids. Like you have 12 kids because you need people to work the farm. You need to replace some because half of them are going to die because of some preventable disease, infant mortality, blah, blah, blah. Like most intelligent humans, and humans are defined by our intelligence, won't just have babies. Like the Duggar situation, you know, where like people just like, hey, I just want to have fucking 20 kids or whatever. That's kind of crazy.
Sure. I mean,
that's
I've seen
like Idiocracy. Outside the norm.
I know all about it.
Yeah. So like if that's the case, then like Earth levels off to the 10 or like a stable population or 10 or 12 billion. Some people even think it'll start shrinking back down because the birth rate will go below 1 to 1, and it'll fall to a stable. The 25 billion, like, or 24 billion seems like 2.5 times more than an estimate. So, but again, I do think that you're supposed to understand The Expanse is a bit of a dystopia. That nothing changes the income inequality, the environmental damage, like we kind of tech our way out of it, but it leaves billions and billions and billions of people who have sustenance, but they don't have any kind of like hope for the future. Like, you know, like UBI is not a salvation, it's a chain around your neck. And whether you believe that or not, I guess depends on how the next 100 years go, really.
Sure. Whether we let the Mao Wachowskis or whatever of the universe just own everything, right?
Yeah.
I bet UBI goes a lot farther if you sell off a racing penis or two.
Yeah. But he needs a racing penis, and he needs the mothership that holds three of them.
Or else.
Is freedom really a thing? If Jules Pierre Meow cannot single-handedly stride the stars as a god, you know, like what's the point of having individual dignity and freedom if you can't have one guy being a quintillionaire? I mean, really, are any of us free?
It's true.
If one of us can't be a god, you gotta ask questions like that.
Just gotta honestly. work harder, work more, and be smarter, and all of us have a shot at being quintillionaires.
You got to go back 200 years into the past, have your great-great-great-grandfather invent the railroad drive. And exactly. You have to hit your great-great-great-grandfather had to have the contract to build the North Atlantic seawall. Mm-hmm. And then you, too, can have some green space on Earth and your own private fleet of ships. So that's what we want.
And the second question, how much of the outer planets or moons have been colonized? We know about Phoebe and Ganymede, but Jupiter and Saturn and Uranus definitely have hundreds of moons between them. Do they all have posts or just the viable ones?
I'm gonna cite the Wikipedia article again. It says the United Nations controls the Earth, Luna, Jupiter, Ganymede, Europa, Io, and Callisto, the asteroid belt Ceres and Eros, Uranus, the moon Titania, which I think is the largest moon of that.
They
and
for
Saturn,
sure
the,
control Uranus. Yeah.
And Saturn, the moon of Titan, that one might be the one of the atmosphere I was talking about. And then in Mars controls, of course, Mars, Deimos, and Phobos. Saturn, the moon of Phoebe, and then the Outer Planets Alliance maintain control over Ceres, and that's about it. And other various holdings in the asteroid belt.
Oh, not anymore. They got Pallas. They got.
Yeah. So that's the thing. It's like there's these lesser things. I don't know. Like who actually has control over it,
and how small of a rock is useful to them?
So that's a great question, but it seems like it's more of like is a place viable? You know, is the expense to hollow out an asteroid and spin stabilize it is like, as that's like, you know, a big expense. And I guess the Tycho Corporation did a lot of that kind of work, versus like building space stations. And now that you got the great frontier opening up, it's, but I imagine any asteroid worth the problem here, the asteroid belt is it's not infinite. Like for example, Ceres, I think contains 15% of the total mass of the asteroid belt. I know Pallas, cause I just looked it up, is another 9%. There's Vesta, the one that's in between, that's kind of shaped like a potato. It's one of the only ones of its size. It's not like spheroid, contains like another, like 11. So like there, those three planets contain a third of the mass, the habitable area of the asteroids. Like you get down out of the top 10 asteroids and you're talking just like, you might mine those rocks. You might haul them back for water and platinum and shit, but to live on them? Mm-hmm. Nah, not really. And same way, like you get outside the main, the Galilean moons of Jupiter, and they're just weird, mismatched, you know, captured asteroids, essentially. So there's just not that much space once you get past those main installations.
That's the thing about
Venus
the belters.
Venus is uninhabitable. Mars is uninhabitable. Maybe you can do like those cloud city type things in the upper atmosphere of Mars that people have kind of talked about. But like there's...
Mars? No, you're talking about...
Did I say Mars? I meant Venus.
Okay.
I meant Venus.
Yeah.
That you can have these cloud city operations floating on the dense atmosphere of Venus. I've seen some like, you know, futurist speculation on that. But yeah, there's not a lot out there in space for us.
That's the thing. The belters were never meant to be a civilization, right? They're meant to be a workforce for the inner planets. And they've turned into, you know, over generations, their own culture, their own civilization. And they've got to feel like they're stuck in a bottle.
But good news, I just read an interview with Elon Musk yesterday. It says he's planning on colonizing Mars, and if you can't afford to get there, don't worry. There's going to be corporations that'll pay you, and you just work a couple years,
and you can work all that payment off. And you can spend your money at the company store, and you can live in the company apartment. And it's a situation that rhymes with edentured burvitude. and it's nothing. It's a policy that's never been tried on Earth before. I'm really excited to see where it goes. I'm really excited to see what the South African ruby miner comes up with for acceptable working conditions for these people. It's boy, whew. So exciting. I'm signing up. I've had enough Earth. I want to try.
The dream of Mars lives on in Elon Musk, baby. Oh yeah.
The nightmare of Mars, more like it. But yeah, like isn't that hilarious that you've got a guy who's like not even like he's just laying it out like, "Yeah, don't worry. We'll fly you there. You just have to, you know, work makes free."
Yeah. Yeah.
So, there you go.
That's it. That's all we got for feedback for this week.
Yeah, send us some more, expanse@baldmove.com, and don't forget, every Sunday, we have Sci-Fi Sunday, where we watch two really fun episodes of Star Trek, and boy, we're in the middle of just the golden age of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah.
This episodes we're going to be looking at this week, I know one of them is Data creating a child. That's inherently interesting. It's a fun concept. And then we're going to look at the week's episode, The Expanse, with a bunch of rabid Expanse fans. It's a lot of fun. It's happening at twitch.tv/baldmove. It's free to participate in. All you need is a free Twitch account and an Amazon Prime account. If you got those two, about 30 seconds hooks those accounts together. And you can watch the episode live with us, sync to our commentary and chat. It's a lot of fun. It's 8 p.m. Eastern. It happens every Sunday night. twitch.tv/baldmove. Hope you got see you guys there.
We're also posting these podcasts as video podcasts on YouTube if you guys are interested in checking those out. We have a YouTube channel that we post a lot of stuff to pretty regularly. So youtube.com/baldmove if you're not a Twitch person but you still want video.
Yeah, if you want to see kind of like the other stuff Bald Move does, we do lots of TV shows, lots of movie reviews, and stuff of that nature on youtube.com/baldmove.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that'll wrap us up for this week. Can't wait to see what happens. How does Naomi MacGyver her way out of this crazy situation she's found herself into? We'll find out together next week. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Later.